Want to welcome you all to the third edition of Trail Tales. Thanks again to the 49th State Brewery. On behalf of the Chugach Park Fund and Alaska Trails, I want to welcome you all here tonight. We didn't have to battle the weather last night, as you all know. It was a very nice evening, and tonight not so much. So thanks for coming out. My name is Steve Cleary. I'm the Executive Director of Alaska Trails. Happy to have you all here tonight for some great stories. But first, I want to take 7 minutes myself. I'm going to limit it to that. We were gently reminded we were a little long-winded last time with the intro. So I get 7 minutes as well, and that's it. And we have this handy card that I hope you all have about our upcoming events, which I will go through in reverse order. So we're happy to announce that November 28th, there'll be another Trail Tales event right here. So if you've got ideas, my email's on there. We want to have another great set of stories that night as well. Also, in this very room on October 19th, we'll be having our fall fundraiser. We do a silent auction with lots of great stuff. Alaska Railroad tickets, REI gear, Skinny Raven gift cards, Moose's Tooth gift cards, lots of cool stuff, cabin stays out at Eagle River and other places. So please come and support us on October 19th. We are planning a mountain bike summit coming up October 6th and 7th at the Kincaid Chalet. We're bringing up experts with the Bureau of Land Management and the International Mountain Biking Association to come and teach Alaskans about trail building, but also about building a network and organizations and advocacy around mountain biking and the health and economic impacts, positive benefits that they bring. That's something we also do at our Trails Conference in April of every year. And I get to do it tomorrow in Valdez at a conference called Confluence, where I'll be talking about active transportation, the benefits of trails, biking and walking, and some of our Safe Routes to School work. And we've got some boards in the back outlining our Safe Routes to School goals. We've got a grant from the American Heart Association to try to promote and advocate for consistent funding for Safe Routes to School in Alaska, because we believe that it's really great for kids to have a safe way to walk and bike to school. And as a parent of a 9-year-old, that's especially important to me. It brings health benefits, but they also do better academically in school as well. And so at the top of our list on your card is the Alaska Trail Stewards, and that's the program I want to share the most with you about tonight. It's becoming our signature effort at Alaska Trails. We're about to finish our second full season of volunteer trail projects, and that will culminate on September 30th, which is National Public Lands Day. And we have 6 more spots for that event. You can sign up with our volunteer coordinator in the back, Caitlin Gwynn. Caitlin, can you wave? She's back there. So during the break, you can go back and sign up there. And we hope to have a full slate of 30 volunteers that day working in Chugach State Park on the backside of Flat Top. But even if you can't make it that day, you can sign up, and we're going to be going strong next summer. So our first summer, not this summer, but last summer, we just worked with Chugach State Park, did 4 good events, and really had a good, solid start. But this year, we branched out to new partners, including the BLM, the U.S. Forest Service. I saw Irene come in, one of our volunteers who biked 16 miles in to the place where she volunteered, along with another volunteer, I should say, for 3 days in a row. So there's been a lot of great projects, and we're happy to see it expanding. We've had nearly 100 volunteers this summer, donating nearly 800 hours, which equates to more than $21,000 in volunteer labor. But more importantly, it's a connection to the trails that they love, and a great way for people to come back. So I was mentioning Irene, but are there any others who volunteered at Alaska Trail Stewards events and have participated in it? So we really appreciate your efforts, and we hope to see more of you out there. It's a great project because it's brought in so many different partners for us. We've got REI, Alaska Geographic, Student Conservation Association, the U.S. Forest Service, and most particularly the National Park Service Rivers, Trails, and Conservation Assistance Program. So it's this expanding network of people who really care about trails, and you all know, and we keep hearing the refrain of budgets shrinking. Well, this is a way for people to give back to their public lands, like on National Public Lands Day, and really make a difference for the trails that they love. We've had good financial support as well from ConocoPhillips, Kenai Mountain Turnagain Arm Heritage Area, and the Wilderness Stewardship Alliance. And so finally, I would like to ask you for your support as well. We'd like you all to become members of Alaska Trails. You can go to our website and sign up there. We're also on Pick, Click, Give. We're in the workplace giving campaigns, the combined federal campaign and the SHARE campaign. But we really appreciate you being here tonight, and we'd like you to continue that support with volunteering, with becoming a member, and seeing you at some of these upcoming events. So thanks again for being here tonight, and I'm going to move on to our first storyteller. Ben Schneider is actually on the board of the Chugach Mountain Bike Riders, and they are having a volunteer event this Saturday using our tool trailer to work on the great trails out at Mirror Lake. And we're in the process of working with the Chugach Mountain Bike Riders to write another RTP grant for phase two of the trails that they're gonna build out there. So that's not really Ben's bio though. That's me still talking over my 7 minutes. I apologize. Back to Ben. Ben Schneider began his job as a stay-at-home dad for two kids and seven dogs 6 years ago. There's a lot of math there. When he moved to Alaska and lived in a yurt, he now lives in a regular house and spends his time woodworking, dog mushing, skiing, rafting, fishing, biking, teaching, and tearing out his hair while trying to wrangle his two kids. Please welcome Ben Schneider.
So I'm a little exhausted this week because I've been teaching kindergarten since Monday. So this story I'm about to tell, I actually told a few years ago for Arctic Entries, but it was at the pack, and all the seats were filled except for one right in the front, which belonged to my wife. And from a gross miscommunication, I actually sent my wife here instead of to the pack. So I'm pretty excited because tonight, my wife, my story, and myself are all in the same spot. And so I get a second go at this. So here we go. So I'd like to start with a confession. You see, about 10 years ago, I was on a college trip to Australia, and I killed a baby kangaroo with my bare hands. But really, this story starts a few years earlier than that, when I was out for a hike with my dog and my mom's 50 and over women's hiking group. Now, my dog's name was Cap, and Cap was this 90-pound all-white sheepdog, and he was a super athlete, and I could take him anywhere. But Cap had his problems, one of which was that he liked to kill things. Squirrels, birds, porcupines, and skunks. And as I would find out later, Cap also liked to kill really big things. Now, my mom's hiking group consisted of about 10 women, and these women could hike. They had their hiking poles and their cute hiking outfits. They were out there hiking, and they were really making it look good. So we're hiking out this trail, and we're going to this alpine lake, and we're on the side of a hill, and there's this gully that leads all the way to the bottom of the valley. And as we're hiking, all of a sudden we see this puff of dust and this thing streak down into the gully. And I know that Cap likes to chase things, and so I reach down to grab him, but he's already gone chasing after whatever this thing was. And I sort of feebly call for him just to make a show for my mom's hiking group, but I know Cap's not going to come back. And so I start walking down the gully, and I tell the hiking group, I'll see you in a little bit and get my dog. And so I'm going down and calling, and I'm going down this gully, and I'm calling more and more and more, and my frustration and anger is just building because this is not the first time something like this has happened. And finally I get to a point where I'm ready to just leave Cap there and let him answer the call of the wild and fend for himself. when all of a sudden, right beside some pine trees, his head pops up and I see him. But my all-white dog is now covered in red and black, blood and gore. And at first I think he's injured, and so I run over there and I check him all over, but he's jumping around and his tail's wagging and he doesn't seem to be in any pain. And that's when I hear another rustling sound over by the trees, and I go over there and there's this large domestic sheep laying on its side and its throat is all torn up. And I look down at Cap, and Cap looks at me with his super happy, silly dog face, and I can tell he's totally excited and happy about what he's just done. And so I tie him up because I don't want him to do any more damage than he's already done to the sheep. So I tie him to a tree, and I go down to see what I can do about this sheep. And when I get down there, I can tell that it's mortally wounded. It's not going to live. And I know that I can't just leave it there to die by itself, but I don't have a gun, and I don't have a knife, and I don't know how to go about breaking a sheep's neck. And so I look around for what else I have, and I find this basketball-sized rock, and I think to myself, how hard can it be, right? You take this rock, you smash the sheep's head, you break its skull, you kill it instantly. That easy, right? So I pick up the rock and I walk over to the sheep, and as I walk over there, the sheep looks up at me with these big, dumb eyes, and I can tell it's thinking to itself, thank God, a human, I'm saved. But that's when I take that rock and I crash it down on its head as hard as I can. And then I pick the rock up, and the sheep lifts its head up. And it baas, the most pitiful sound that you've ever heard. But at this point, it's worse off than when Cap got done with it, and so I'm committed. And so I take the rock, and I hit it again. And I hit it again, and again. And I'm going crazy now. My dog's barking like crazy, and I'm getting frustrated, and I just have to bash it over the head over and over until finally it's not moving and it's not breathing. I don't check for a pulse, but it's dead. I'm sure of it. And so I stand up on shaky legs and I drop the rock and I go back to Cap and I untie him from the tree and we start heading back up the gully. And we're going up and up and up, and I look at myself, and I'm covered with blood from the top of my head down to my knees and all down my arms. And my dog is covered in blood. And we go up and up and back to my mother's 50 and over women's hiking group. And anything that you're thinking right now that their faces might have looked like is exactly how they looked. Jaws dropped, stunned silence. And I try to think of something funny to say to them, like, yeah, but you see the other guy and his sheepdog. But I don't, and I just say, Cap took down a sheep, and I killed it, and we need to wash off. I'll see you at the lake. And so we go running up the trail to the lake, and I'm just thinking to myself, please don't let there be any other hikers on the trail, because what would you say to them? But thankfully, mercifully, there aren't any other hikers, and we make it to the lake, and I take Cap and I just throw him into the lake and I scrub him off and I get myself all washed off, and after we're done, we're all clean, I sit in the sunshine with my dog and I throw my arm around him and I rough him up a bit and I forgive him because he's just a dog. But I have a harder time forgiving myself, and I have a hard time convincing myself that what I did was the best possible thing to do, that the way I killed that sheep was better than just leaving it there by itself to die on its own. And I know one thing at that point, I never ever want anything like this to ever happen to me again, and it never ever has, except this one time. You see, about 10 years ago, I was on a college trip to Australia. You might have forgotten about that kangaroo. But I was driving with some friends, and it was dark at night, and I'm at the wheel, and my friends are with me in the car, and all of a sudden, this baby kangaroo jumps in front of the car, and I screech the brakes, but I can't stop in time, and I hit it, and it flies through the air, and it bounces off the pavement, and it stumbles off to the side into a ditch, and we all get out of the car, and we go to see the damage that we've done, and when we look at it, we can tell that its hip's broken, and it's not going to live. We're all standing there wondering what to do, when all of a sudden I look to the side of the road and I see this basketball-sized rock laying on the side of the road. And so I pick it up and I walk over to my friends and I say, "Don't worry, guys, I've got this. Thank you."
Wow, thanks, Ben. it's a good lead-off. Our next story will come from Kay Shoemaker Howell. I first met Kay at some, as I recall anyway, at some meetings for things like Schools on Trails and Get Outdoors Anchorage, where she was a dynamo, a real leader of those groups, getting great projects done, getting kids outdoors. She began her outdoor and environmental education career in Mexico. She's worked for the Girl Scouts of Alaska and at the BLM Campbell Creek Science Center. She got a Master's of Science in Outdoor and Environmental Ed at APU while writing a book on ecology and storytelling. She enjoys kayaking, skiing with her family, and currently working on the Kenai Peninsula for 4-H designing and teaching youth development and environmental education camps and programs. Please welcome Kay Shoemaker Howell.
So, any tweens out there? Any tweens? A few? Yeah? All right, anybody have a tween or a teenager? All right. Anybody was a tween or a teenager once upon a time? Right, okay, so here's what I know about tweens. They're smart, they're wicked smart. And sometimes in their wicked smartness, they connive to do crazy wild things. And after having taught tweens for the better part of 30 years, I've learned a lot from them. But this story has to do with some of those patterns that I see in the tweens all the time. And I want to thank, by the way, the National Park Service RTCA program for helping me be here tonight, so I don't have to be on the Kenai Peninsula, but I get to share with you and kids in Anchorage too for the Schools on Trails program. So here's what I know. Sometimes those tweens and those teens that we know, or those characteristics that maybe we saw in ourselves, well, we're a lot like ravens. And here's how I know that. These are true stories. So the first part of my career here in Alaska, I was in Juneau, and I traveled throughout Southeast Alaska using the Alaska Marine Highway system. So you're traveling around on ferries, and it's a pretty sweet way to work. So I travel around from village to village, going to all these different coastal communities and teaching kids and having a really great time. So I got into this one community, and I walked out to the beach with one of the folks who were trying to set up this camp with me, and I was really hungry, and so that day we had gone out there, I had brought out like a, you know, picnic lunch and a blanket, and I spread it out on the beach, and I spread out the picnic lunch, and I was super, super hungry. And I get all the food set out, and I just sit down in the sand, and I'm looking out at the waves, and I'm thinking, wow, I love Southeast Alaska. I have a sweet job. And all of a sudden, I hear in the Sitka spruce right behind me, I hear this, "Mama, mama." And I'm thinking, wow, maybe there's like a lost kid in there or something. I don't know, but you know, the little thing in me that responds to emergencies and kids who need help and things like that, you know, turns on. And so I leave my nice little picnic blanket, all the food spread out on it, and I go back into the Sitka spruce trees, and I'm looking around, looking for some kid who's calling out for the mama. And then all of a sudden, I turn around, and sure enough, that raven who had said, "Mama, mama," from the tree was down on my picnic blanket eating my food. It's a true story. So that was my first clue. I mean, I knew all along that, you know, corvids are super smart birds, and ravens, being one of the largest of the corvid family, they got a lot of intelligence going on. But later that year, I was in another community, and we were out by some mud flats, and the other instructor who was working with me was down with a group of about five kids, and they were going after shrimp in the mud flats. And they had these really cool shrimp sluicer things that they like suck the shrimp right out of the sand. It's pretty cool. And so the kids are all having a really great time with this, and they're all totally, you know, focused on this, and they really want to use these shrimp sluicer things and go after these shrimp, and they're, you know, digging in there with their hands, and they're checking out the burrows, and they're looking at the little peaks and little valleys and figuring out how they live, and they're having a great time. But they're out on the mudflats, right? So their backpacks are way up where the grasses are, the dune grasses are, you know, a good 100 yards or so up from the dune grasses. I mean, where they are in the mudflats to the dune grass, about 100 yards. So the kids are up there on the mudflats, and as I'm looking out there with the instructor, all of a sudden, I hear the squawking up in this group of Sitka spruce, and I look up in the spruce trees, and there are about six ravens up there, and they're squawking, they're squawking, they're squawking, and they don't stop for a while, and I'm watching them, and I'm thinking, what are they doing up there? So, you know, I just kind of sit down, and I watch them, because I love to watch wildlife. It's one of those things, you know, it entertains me about as much as kids do. So, in any case, I'm watching these ravens, and pretty soon three of them fly down from the tree out to the mudflats where the kids are, and they start flopping around out on the mudflats, and they're making a whole bunch of sounds, and they're like, wah, 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 wah. And the kids, of course, are like, what? Totally distracted. And, you know, the instructor's trying to teach, and I'm about ready to run out there and just shoo the ravens away, but the curiosity got the best of me, so I got to watch them for a little while. And sure enough, they keep squawking, they keep squawking. The other three ravens fly down from the same tree. Mind you, they've been talking about this ahead of time. They fly down from that same tree, and they go down to where the backpacks are, out there where the grasses are and the dune grass. And I watch these ravens one at a time. A raven would put its little foot down on a backpack, and another raven would take its beak onto the zipper, and another one would hold the other part of the backpack, and they'd open the zipper one by one, and they'd take the peanut butter and jelly sandwich out of the backpack. I kid you not, I watched them. Now, I didn't stop them because I had extra sandwiches in my backpack, so I knew the kids were going to eat okay. But they went from backpack to backpack, all five or six backpacks. I don't remember how many kids were there, but they went to every single backpack, did the same thing. One stepped on it, another one grabbed the zipper. Now, evolution says that ravens should know nothing about zippers, right? It's not a part of their normal, you know, wildlife adaptation thing, but they have adapted way faster than we give them credit for, right? And they're super good problem solvers. Anyway, so they go to each backpack, one at a time, unzip it, take out the sandwich, unzip it, take out the sandwich. I'm watching this, and it's totally blowing my mind. And these other ravens are over there where the kids are, totally creating a distraction. Blah, 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 blah. And sure enough, as soon as these three ravens in the dune flats, they have all of the sandwiches pulled out of the backpacks. They grab the sandwiches in their talons, and they fly back up to that same spruce tree. And these other three ravens who are creating the distraction leave the kids, and they fly up to the same spruce tree, and I watch them eat those kids' lunch together, the criminals that they are. Now, you may not know this, but a group of ravens is called a murder, right? I'm absolutely convinced that if ravens wanted to, they really could murder if they needed to. That was a lot of conspiracy there. So I'm just saying, while you're out on the trails, while you're out watching the wildlife, you'll be amazed. And I like to draw parallels between people and animals and get kids connected to the stories that connect us all and make us all a part of this beautiful thing that we share out there. So thank you.
Thanks a lot, Kay. That was great. Our next storyteller is Jason Slemons. Jason was born and raised in Eagle River in Chugiak, and he grew up hiking, camping, hunting, and burning marshmallows. In his teens and 20s, he studied math at half a dozen schools across the country. He escaped, he says, largely unscathed, and moved back to Alaska with his wife, Leah, where they had two children, Frida and Daphne's here tonight in the back there. Hey, Daphne. He has found a renewed interest in fat biking, mountain biking, and road biking, and camping with his family in their 30-year-old Toyota RV. Please welcome Jason Slemons.
Thanks. So many of you are probably familiar with the phenomenon of having a friend or an acquaintance from outside, from the lower 48, come up during the summer and visit you for a week while you play host. So this happened to me and to my family in the summer of 2014, it was, with one important difference, and that is that the acquaintance was someone I had never met, but my wife knew, and my wife and family were gone that week. So I was going to play host to Tony, who I'd never met before, but who was German and was a graduate student in the Midwest in something I don't remember. But you know, the trails build community. We hear it all the time, and I was like, well, we're going to show this guy around. So about midway through the week, I thought we should go mountain biking. And he had biked some, never mountain biked, but we went up, I took him to the hillside trails. And for those of you who don't know, the hillside trails are a bunch of single track mountain biking trails in and around Hilltop and below Prospect Heights. So I took him up, it's not far from our house, so we just biked. And we went up the drone lane, then we went up Janice's Jive, and then we went decided to go down the Hive. Actually, sidebar, Janice's Jive is the best name for a mountain bike trail that we have ever had. It's like, am I learning how to dance disco, or am I mountain biking? Anyway, so Tony and I, we start down the Hive, and he's not real fast, so I'm waiting every now and then to make sure that he's fine. I want to be around if he falls or something. So I take a turn around one of the corners in Janice's Jive, and sure enough, I pass a bear. And it's maybe 5 yards away, and I think this is probably the only bear I've ever seen on these trails. And I remember it being brown, but that's probably not true, and I keep telling myself that. So I see the bear. He's largely uninterested. He probably heard me coming, and I don't want Tony to see him and freak out, so I stop maybe 10 yards down the trail. I get my bear spray out. I take the safety off. I start banging my bell and making a lot of noise so that when Tony comes, he can see me and he can tell that I'm there. And I can tell him, you know, get behind me, Tony, and we'll just keep going. Sure enough, Tony shows up, and I say, hey, you know, get behind me. And as soon as he shows up, of course, he sees the bear and his eyes get really wide. And there's this moment where I'm like, is he going to listen to this direction? But he does. He gets right behind me, and the bear, still uninterested, I think, okay, we can probably leave. So I go and I take my bear spray and I put it back in the holster, and I sort of, my holster was right here, and put it right in the holster, right? Just important to put the safety back on. So I sprayed myself from like here to my eye, and I even have this like, in that moment, which time slows down for, by the way, in case you've never been through this, I have this very vivid memory of like watching the spray actually toward my eye. The other thing I realized in that moment, beyond the fact that like 37 years old, I've never experienced that much pain before, was that I really wasn't worried about Tony anymore. And like building community and meeting this guy, not on the top of my list. So I did have the presence of mind sometime after that to think, oh, I should put the safety back on and get that in my holster and put some distance between me and the bear. And about that time, I heard Tony say something like, oh, what is that? Because I had forgotten to warn him what it was. So we turn around and put some more distance between the bear, and I'm like, okay, we gotta get down. I wanna get home. I wanna find out, you know, if I'm ever gonna see again, how long I've got to live, whatever. Because I'm pretty sure I'm going to lose the sight out of this eye. So anyway, I'm kind of making my way down the Janice's, or the Hive, and we actually run into this doctor, and I told him what was going on. He's like, yeah, you should flush your eye out. And I'm like, oh, that's a good idea. But I forgot to tell you, I already flushed my eye out, and it didn't do anything. So thanks for nothing. So we keep going. I'm pretty self-absorbed. I've kind of forgotten to stop for Tony every now and then. And I stop. I think it was about the top of Hilltop. Like, I pulled out onto the where the ski area actually is. And I flush my eye out again. And it actually got a lot better. I think it had only been maybe 30 minutes since I, you know, tried to blind myself. But it was feeling pretty good at that point. And I kind of came out of my shell a little. I got a little less self-absorbed. And I realized that I had no idea where Tony was. I completely lost him. And, you know, there's kind of a maze of trails. So I got kind of worried about that. So I started biking around. I actually backtracked a little. I never saw him. I biked down. I biked over. I biked around. No Tony. I actually ran into that doctor again. And I said, hey, have you seen the German that was with me? And he's like, and he was German? So after a while, I kind of gave up. And I thought, well, I'll go home. And maybe he made his way home. Or maybe I can call him. And by the time I actually got home, I should say that the eye didn't hurt as much. My face was still on fire. But I really did want to know if Tony was okay. And sure enough, I got home, and he was there. He'd even gone over to the neighbors and tried to call me. What a great guy. And he wanted to know how I was doing. And I was like, man, what a great guy. And I'm like, I'm doing pretty bad. My face still feels like it's on fire. But in that moment, just like when I sprayed myself, time kind of slowed down because I realized that even though I didn't really know Tony like 40 minutes ago, he was my best friend now. And like I talked to him for months after that. I still talked to him. I talked to him about the story. And so a lot of building community, you know, it sounds really great, especially when you're talking about trails, and it is really great, but sometimes it hurts your eyes. Thank you.
Awesome. Thanks a lot, Jason. Our next storyteller, Jennifer Johnston. I was trying to remember when I first met her. She used to lead trips up to the Kotzebue area, the Nana region, to teach kids how to cross-country ski. And my wife and I went on one in the, 2003, 2004 range. I believe that was the precursor to Ski Ku and Nana Nordic, and it's kind of taken off since then, but she's done a lot of giving back to the community like that. There was, and I was about to say how, which she does inspire me to get outside and do a lot of stuff. But while I was sitting there just now, I remembered that each night, so we'd go around to different schools in the area. I think we went to four different villages and teach. And so we'd be out in the freezing cold, all like minus, you know, trying to cross country ski in this. And then she would try to get everybody to do sit-ups at night. And like, I never do sit-ups, and I certainly wasn't going to do them after a long day out trying to teach kids to cross-country ski. But other than that, I'm really inspired by her. And I remember at least one occasion, perhaps more, when she was on the assembly, I would see her biking to one of the endless series of meetings that Anchorage assembly members go to, and I just was amazed to see her getting exercise on the way to what could have been a 3, 4, 5, or 6 hour meeting. Jennifer and her husband, Alan, moved to Fairbanks in 76 and then to Anchorage in 1988. Since then, Jennifer has worked as an outdoor educator, owned a small business, and most recently served 3 terms on the Anchorage Assembly, and then is now serving in her first term in the Alaska State House of Representatives. When she's not busy, she loves to hike, ski, and climb, but most of all, spend time with her 3 kids and 5 grandkids. Please welcome Jennifer Johnston.
Well, I have quite a few apologies to start out with. Will it count into my 7 minutes? First of all, when Steve asked me to do this, I was sucked a lot of air because all I could think of are the number of stories other people would tell about going out with me and how I'd say it's just around the corner, just over the hill, we're almost there. Oh yeah, that was the peak. And then I also, trying to do this 7 minutes, I have a whole bunch of funny stories go along with this, but I had to cut them all out. So I apologize. As Steve said, I've been able to experience a lot, and one of my most favorite things has been skiing up north. And that all started in 1997 with Norman Vaughn's first serum run. And I'm not sure if all of you know of or ever heard of Norman Vaughn, but Norman Vaughn drove dogs in Admiral Byrd's first expedition in Antarctica, and he moved to Alaska full-time and when he was over 70 years old to mush in the Iditarod. Well, the Iditarod was kind of getting tired of Norman, and they kind of ruled them out. They had three rules that were not Norman-friendly. One was you could no longer accept the hospitality of people in the villages, and he liked eating and sleeping in their homes. The other, you couldn't have outside help at the checkpoints, and Norman was in his 90s at that point, and he really needed the outside help. And the last rule was the Norman Vaughan rule, that if you're going too slow and it was a risk to the rest of the race, then you could be scratched. But this didn't bother Norman. He created his own adventure, and what it was a serum run, and he went the original route, which was Nenana to Nome. And what he was going to do is he's going to have dog sleds and snow machines and all be self-contained. Well, Vern Tejas and I and our daughter Merrick decided to meet them in Unalakleet and do the coastal part of the Iditarod. Now, the other part of this was that Norman was going to go into the villages and speak at the schools and tell them of adventures, his adventures, and use that as a way to have them also dream big and dare to fail. If you knew Norman, those were his lines. And when Merrick caught up with him, she would go into the schools with him because she had her adventures, and at that point she was the youngest one to climb Denali. So they had their little dog and pony show. So their first day out of Unalakleet was a beautiful bluebird sky day, and actually quite warm. And we didn't get going until about 10:30, and from Unalakleet to Shaktulik is 40 miles. Merrick was really struggling, and the snow was heavy. So luckily a snow machiner came along and gave her a ride to Shaktulik. So there was Vern and I. And the beginning part, or most of the part of the 40 miles, is rolling hills out of Unalakleet. And talk about false peaks. You just think you're almost there, and then you're down again. And it was hot. By the time we got back down onto the ice, it was dark. And actually Vern was out of water, out of food, and he was not doing well. So I was real excited when we saw the lights and say, we're almost there. Well, it was Old Shaktulik, and Old Shaktulik's just a fish camp, and there's no one there. So I did something that I was not comfortable doing, but it was the best thing I could do, was I gave Vern everything I had, and I kept skiing into Shaktulik. Luckily, it was only about 4 miles, and when I got there, the snow machiners were just taking off to go back to see what was happening. That night, the snow machiners were quite angry. They had signed up for dog sleds, but they hadn't signed up for three skiers, one being a 13-year-old. So Norman said, fine, he would take care of us. He had the snow machine. He and Merrick would go speak in the schools, and he'd bring her out to meet us wherever Vern and I were at that point. Vern and I could get an early start, and life was good. Well, Shaktulik, we got out, Vern and I, 5:30, and walked out of the school, and it was a blazing, howling blizzard. I don't think we even got to the slough, and both of my goggles were frozen. So I ended up putting a grabber warmer or a heater into one side to melt it so I could see out of that, and then I shipped it to the other side and back and forth. I think we also went down the wrong slough, so we never saw a snow machine, never saw a dog team. The wind was howling. I had my red nylon suit on, so I was like Teletubby or Barney. And I, you know, there's not a lot of me, so I think I went back as much as I went forward. Finally, about, I guess, probably 10:30, 11, Norman and Merrick came along, and I got on that snow machine, and he took us to the shelter cabin and then got back and got Vern, and then he shuttled us to the bluff where we had some protection, and we skied into Koyuk. As we skied into Koyuk, the weather was breaking, and there were a lot of healthy, happy kids skiing. And it was a beautiful sight. And I'm not sure if any of you know John Miles, but John Miles was a teacher in Koyuk, and he and a number of other teachers in the 80s had started a biathlon program up there, and a very robust one. And this is what we saw in each village, where a lot of happy, healthy kids skiing, and it was a great program. Next morning, Vern and I got up at 5:30, and it was just a crystal clear day, dark at 5:30. That was the year that the Hales-Bogg comet, and it was a beautiful tail, almost a full moon, and actually the aurora was just doing whipping in the skies. And the most magical part was that the only thing that broke the stillness was our skis on the snow. So we made it to Nome. We had a lovely time. Our days were 5:30, ski, kids greeting us, Merrick playing at night, enjoying the hospitality of a lot of nice people. But when I tell you I've skied from Unalakleet to Nome, I really haven't. As you know, I didn't ski the 50 miles to Koyuk. I did it what I call the Cadillac version. I didn't have to carry my shelter or my food, just my survival gear. But I did get to know the trail intimately. I got to meet a lot of wonderful people, and I had those magical mornings where the stillness was broken by my skis on the snow.
Thank you, Jennifer. We're going to take a break and allow you to get another drink and something to eat. I just have a couple announcements before then. In the back will be our volunteer coordinator, Caitlin Gwynn, to sign up some more folks who want to help us out on National Public Lands Day. And I meant to mention in my introduction, there's a couple other events happening that day. So should the Alaska Trail Stewards fill up that day, you can join the Single Track Advocates on either the Hillside or Kincaid Trails. And there's also a great event at the Campbell Creek Science Center that's real good for young people and includes free pizza and cookies at noon. So that's always a big draw for the kids. So we've got three more great storytellers, but let's take 10 or 15 minutes right now. And thanks again. We're going to go ahead and get going. If you could take your seats. We've got three more great storytellers for you, and then we'll have some time to socialize after as well. Thanks again to the 49th State Brewing Company for having us here tonight. Don't forget to stop at our table in the back there if you would like to sign up to be an Alaska Trail Steward and do some really fun volunteer trail maintenance. And please do remember to take your upcoming events card home with you, and we hope to see you at some of our upcoming events. And wow, there's a couple nice looking pretzels going around. If anybody ordered a pretzel, you're going to want to get it before I take it. Man. Thanks again for coming, everybody. It's really great. This is our third one, as I mentioned, and it's just really amazed me how much people like to share their stories and how much the community likes to hear it. So we owe a big debt of gratitude to Arctic Entries, who were modeled after. I've stopped saying copied, but we modeled after them, and so it's really fun for us to have great folks telling stories, and thanks to you all for coming. Our next storyteller is Jeff Samuels. As I mentioned in my intro, one of our partners is the Student Conservation Association, so Jeff has helped out a lot with the Alaska Trail Stewards, and we hope that he and SCA will continue to be great partners in that program. Jeff came to Alaska from California 25 years ago to participate in a Knowles National Outdoor Leadership School course for the summer. He ended up returning a couple years later to work for a guiding company on the Kenai, and he's been in Alaska ever since. Jeff and his wife Sharon live in Girdwood, where they spend their free time hiking, skiing, fishing, and foraging. And as I mentioned, he works for the Student Conservation Office here in Alaska as the State Partnership Director. Please welcome Jeff Samuels.
Hi there, good evening. So I'd like to start with a couple of questions, if I may. Could I get a show of hands for how many people here are Alaskans? Born and raised. Wow, born and raised. That's pretty good. Okay, how about how many people first came to Alaska for one summer? They were gonna come up here and do one thing for one summer and then that was it. There's a few of you. Yeah, I guess I'm one of them too. All right, how many people here are completing that first summer right now in Alaska? How many people are wrapping up that very first season up here in the state? There's a few of you, a couple of you. All right, great, right on. That's an enviable place to be, I think, when you're trying to figure out if you're gonna stay up here and what you're gonna do. Alaska is a land of adventure, and what I wanna talk about is how did I find, you know, there's so much adventure and so much excitement, and if you read Outside Magazine, it's filled with stories about people doing really crazy things like skiing, you know, 50 miles or 150 miles to, you know, from village to village. And I was trying to figure out what my threshold was for comfort, you know, for adventure in Alaska and a land that seemed limitless, you know. So I first came to Alaska, as Steve mentioned, to do a Knowles course up here, which is a great entry level thing to do in Alaska to get your feet wet and to figure out what sorts of adventures are out there. I signed up for a summer long course, a semester course, and was kayaking and backpacking and mountaineering around Alaska for 75 days. And I met some really interesting people. The instructors on my course, the mentors on my course, were a couple of people who are still really active in Alaska today. Paul Twardock and Mike Wood were a couple of the folks that mentored me in my first summer up here, and they were people I emulated, even though they weren't a whole lot older than me at the time. And I just tried to figure out, you know, what can I do in Alaska? How can I get out there and do something really, really awesome like they're doing? So I had a pivotal summer that first year. I knew I'd come back. I just didn't know when. But the following summer, I went to the next best place, Bonner's Ferry, Idaho, if any of you are familiar with that area. And I volunteered on a Forest Service trail crew down there for the Bonner's Ferry Ranger District. And I learned how to roll my own smokes and drop start a chainsaw as I logged out miles and miles of trail in Boundary County, Idaho. And in fact, I met a really interesting character down there. There were a number of interesting characters on the local trail crew in Bonner's Ferry. They were the paid guys. I was a volunteer. And we got paired up, volunteers got paired up with the paid guys every day to go out and be a team and to go log out a section of trail. And this one fellow, Mike Fairweather, who was a local, he was pretty crusty, had a heart of gold, born and raised in Bonner's Ferry. He was on work release for the summer. He had gotten into some trouble with some cranberry wine and a dirt bike in Bonner's Ferry, but he was able to come to work every day, which is great. And he and I got paired up pretty early on in my summer to go log out a section of trail for the day. And I remember, you know, I was carrying the Dolmar, I was carrying the fuel, and he was carrying the saw. And he did most of the cutting for the morning, and then all of a sudden, just before lunch, he turns around and hands me the saw. Do you want to cut something down? And I said, you know, yeah, that'd be great, sure. And the first tree we approached is about a 30-foot tall tree. It had a broken off top. It was basically just a log standing up about 30 feet, you know, right alongside the trail. Pretty straightforward, pretty easy to cut, you know, given that you're still cutting down a tree. But I was nervous, you know, it was my first tree to cut down, and Mike had this pretty crazy 1,000-yard stare that he could look right through you or look nowhere all at the same time. You know, you've all bumped into one of these people. And Mike turned around to me and he said, all right, here's your tree. Now just remember two things when you're cutting down a tree. And then seriously, there was this long delay. Two things. two things. Always put the face cut in the direction you want the tree to go. I'll be over here having a cigarette. So that was it. So anyway, my whole summer went about like that. I came back to Alaska the following year. I did find a job. I wanted to be a lodge manager when I came back to Alaska because I figured, oh, I'd been through a Knowles course and I've been on this trail crew. I've got all I need to know to run a bear lodge on the Alaska Peninsula. So I applied to a couple of these places over there, got really polite, you know, no thank you letters, which was really nice of them to even send one back. But I did get hired to drive a shuttle bus on the Kenai Peninsula for a really awesome tourism company. I know, I've totally felt like I was, oh man, I could do so much better. But I got hired by a company called Alaska Wildland Adventures, which is an awesome place to work. And I ended up spending a long time there and progressed, you know, went from a bus driver to a raft guide to a boathouse manager to a lodge manager. And along the way, I was meeting all these other really adventuresome people who were doing really far out things when they weren't guiding on the Kenai River or on the Kenai Peninsula. They were, you know, going to Antarctica in the wintertime, or they were, you know, guiding for polar bears in Churchill, Manitoba, or they were flying their own plane or building their own boat. And again, I thought, boy, how much further can I get? How much further out can I go? You know, there's more to do in this state for sure. And that came to a head last summer when I was invited last minute to join a group that was floating down the Congakut River in the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. It's something I'd always heard about, something I'd always wanted to do, and the opportunity came up. Two of my good friends, Greg and Elise, invited me to go, and I filled that last spot on a private group, seven people on that trip. And it's all it's cracked up to be. The Arctic National Wildlife Refuge is bar none the most wild place I've ever been in my life. If any of you ever get the chance to go, jump at it. If you have been, you know what I'm talking about. We had all kinds of weather within, you know, even 48 hours. You know, we'd get rain, snow, wind, sunshine, got it all. We saw a lot of wildlife. We did not see many other people. And we floated for 10 days from the mountains out to the Beaufort Sea on the coast. And one of the most pivotal moments of that experience was about 4 days in, we had eaten dinner, we'd cleaned up our kitchen, we'd gone to bed, we all had our own tents, and we were all kind of scattered out on this gravel bar a little bit. And at about 12:30, I heard a noise, I heard a swat on my tent fly. And when you're groggy and you don't know what the sound was that woke you up, you're trying to figure out what that sound is, and you're thinking, oh, maybe a snowball just hit my tent. Or maybe a tree limb hit my tent. Nope, it's not snowing and there's no trees. Put my glasses on, I slowly got up, I put my Crocs on my feet and I pulled on a fleece jacket and I stood up out of my tent and I did the 360, you know, and sure enough, there's the tail end of a grizzly bear walking away from my tent over towards our kitchen. And I'm the only one awake and I'm freaking out. I had a can of bear spray but nothing else, and my immediate thought was, I need resources. I need people. I need something, because I'm not going to chase this bear with my can of bear spray and not wake anyone up. So I tiptoed past this guy's tent because I knew he had nothing. And this guy slept like a log. I wasn't going to be able to wake him up. So I kept on going back to my friend Greg's tent. And I knew he had a big handgun. And I figured, well, that's something. We can start with that. And then my friend Shannon had a flare in the next tent over. So I figured, okay, those are a couple of good resources. I should wake them up. I woke them up. They got up right away as soon as I whispered, you know, grizzly bear in camp. And they came out, and we watched this bear for just 2 or 3 minutes. It was poking around in our kitchen. It kind of mouthed a few dry bags. It didn't rip into any. And then it walked over to the rafts, and it sort of stood up on the tubes and tested the tubes a little bit, which is kind of nerve-wracking. We were just like, oh, don't pop our boats, you know, and don't tear our kitchen apart and don't charge at us. We were just sort of had all these thoughts going through our mind at the same time. Eventually, he kind of turned and nosed his way out of camp a little bit, and Shannon took one of the bear banger flares and shot it towards the backside of this bear, and that was it. He took off, and immediately the other folks in our group popped out of their tents, you know, whoa, what's going on? What happened? And we explained that a bear had just been in camp and we had just chased it away. And then Juliet looks at me and she says, well, how did you guys know? How did you know there was a bear in camp? And it occurred to me, oh, yeah, that's right. It swatted my tent. And we walked back over to my tent. Everyone was gathered around me, and we're all looking down at my tent fly, and there's this muddy footprint on my tent fly right above my head. And that was it right there. As I was pointing to the bear paw print, I realized I've reached my comfort level. This is it. This is my threshold. I've been looking for it, and I found it. And while there's great value in places like the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge, there should be wild land out there. It should be protected. There's greater value, I think, in those great little trips we can do on the weekends, you know, whether it's going up to Crow Pass or going to Hatcher Pass or Eklutna Lake or Palmer Creek Road or whatever you want to do on the weekends. There's plenty to do in Alaska without putting yourself in that position. So thank you for listening to my story.
Thanks, Jeff. Our next storyteller is Vicky Ho. Vicky writes cautionary tales for the Alaska Dispatch News. She's got a lot of fans in the audience, yeah. And lots of you may have read that. There was just one yesterday or today. But anyway, she writes about lessons learned the hard way in the outdoors when she's not exploring the Chugach Mountains. She's thinking about them and all the ways they are trying to kill her. So please welcome Vicky Ho.
So I'm used to doing a lot of things alone, but that wasn't always the case. You know, before I moved here from Colorado, I never would have hiked alone, never would have camped alone. But I moved here alone, and I had a boyfriend at the time, and he was supposed to join me that fall. This was, when I moved here, it was back in January 2015. A few months later, I got dumped. I mean, I was so sad. I was a complete sad sack. I threw myself into work. I signed up to work 70 hours a week. No one does that. And I didn't really have much of a social life. And so I thought to myself, man, Alaska is a terrible place to be alone, right? And I came to a decision one day. I thought, you know, I could either wallow in self-pity forever, or I could try to enjoy some of what Anchorage has to offer. I chose the second path, and I started hiking. And I have to apologize to the Chugach in general. I would start off hiking at this really angry pace. I was still so upset and so sad. Yeah, I'd be like stomping around, I'd be sweating, I'd be muttering obscenities under my breath. I was the crazy person on the trail that you did not want to run into. And so I'm sorry if you saw me in those early days. But as I would follow the trail, I would approach a summit, you know, get to a lake, be looking up at the canopy of the trees, and I would think, God, this is overwhelming and this is beautiful. And I mean, I loved being out there. But as I was hiking, I was like, man, what was I so upset about in the first place? Completely forgot. So for me, solo hiking is a little bit like free therapy. But there is one trip last spring that really tested how much I love solitude. So last April, I went out to the Rabbit Lake Trailhead after work. I work nights. So I got to the trailhead around 11 p.m. And night hiking is kind of standard operating procedure with me because I've lost my mind. And I strapped on my pack, and I headed out in the snow. And after a couple miles, you know, I got tired and lazy, and the wind started picking up. And for anyone who's been back in that valley when it's windy, you know that the farther back you get, the worse that wind is. And I knew that at the time, so I thought, you know, I'll stop, I'll head out to the side of the trail, I'll set up camp, I'll go to sleep, it'll be fine. And I climbed into my tent. And while the wind outside wasn't necessarily so bad, once I got into my tent, it was a different story. So if you've seen the movies where there's an engineer or a group of engineers testing out some kind of equipment for a plane or a spacecraft, and they flip a switch, and it activates a wind tunnel, and you hear that whooshing sound all around you in this giant cavernous space, that's what it felt like to be in the tent at that moment. And it felt like a giant was just shaking that tent for a really long time, just some bored giant. I was like, ah. And so I thought, God, I don't know how I'm ever gonna sleep in this tent, but I'm out here, I'm committed. I would see the lights of Anchorage through the tiny little plastic vinyl window of my tent. And that was comforting to me. That was reassuring. I mean, my car is only a few miles away. And eventually I drifted off to sleep. But then about half an hour later, I woke up to the feeling of my tent sliding downhill in the snow. And I don't know if you've ever experienced that sensation before. I just hope to God you never do, because you can't see anything. You can't see anything outside of your tent. All you feel is just, you're going downhill, this tent is taking you down with it. And I stopped briefly, there are some bushes there, thought, oh, like, what can I do? And then the wind picked up again and sent me down farther. Finally, I came to a stop against some branches, and I dug in an elbow in one corner of my tent, and the heel of my foot in the opposite corner of the tent. My back was braced against the wall. The wind was threatening to send me like end over end down the hillside, and that was the one thing I did not want to happen. So I was like, God, what? Like, a reasonable person at that point says, hey, I'll pack up, I'll go home. But when you're out in the backcountry a lot on your own, you develop a sort of stubborn streak. And sometimes that really helps you. That helps get you through some difficult situations, some weird terrain. You know, sometimes stubbornness really helps you. In this case, it worked against me. And so I spent, I was like this, elbow in one corner, heel on the opposite, back against the wall. I stayed like that in the world's worst game of Twister for about 2 hours. And I would drift off to sleep, and then the wind would pick up again, and I'd jolt awake, and all of my muscles would tense up all over again. So finally, I gave up. Said, hey, this is a horrible idea. And when I was packing up, I saw that my tent had slid all of 15 feet. But in my mind, you know, it could have been 1,500 feet. I had no idea what was going on. So I started hiking back to my car. And by that time, first light started to arrive. The sky was gray overhead, and slowly the clouds went away. And it was the most beautiful sunrise I'd ever seen. Like, God, it'd be such a shame to waste this morning. But I hiked back, got to my car, started driving out, and there's one intersection where if I go straight, that's the road that takes me home. But I found myself like a woman possessed. I turned the steering wheel right, and I ended up at the trailhead to Wolverine Peak. So I hiked up to Wolverine Peak, and there's this feeling that I get on almost every hike where I look around and I think, you know, man, I feel so bad for anyone who isn't right here at this moment, at this time, right now. You know, at this place, there's nowhere else I would rather be. I felt that way when I was at Wolverine, even after this hellish night off the Rabbit Lake Trail. And in that moment, I also thought to myself, man, Alaska's a great place to be alone. So thank you.
Thanks a lot, Vicki. That was great. Our final storyteller is Pierre Schwab. Pierce first hopped on a bike in the swamplands of Central Florida, where two wheels proved useful in dodging gators. When he wasn't recreating alongside reptiles, he was following his passion for achieving sustainability by studying and applying techniques to help people reduce their carbon footprint. And along those lines, Pierce planned and promoted alternative fuel vehicles in Northern California. He's a recent newcomer to Anchorage, but is excited about the prospects for biking here in Anchorage, and he was recently hired as the first director of Bike Anchorage. Yeah, let's give him a hand for that. I have a personal stake in that. I was one of the founders of Bike Anchorage in 2008. It was the Bicycle Commuters Alliance, then the Bicycle Commuters of Anchorage. Anyway, I've been dreaming about somebody like Pierce taking the reins for almost 10 years, and so I'm happy that it's happened. And in addition, Alaska Trails got a grant from AARP to work on two issues here in Anchorage, the update of the non-motorized transportation plan and a complete streets policy. So I'll be working with Pierce to try to get you all to send in comments on those two important things, and it's a nice bookend with our Safe Routes to School program to be working with the AARP, another great partner on active transportation. Without further ado, here's Pierce.
Well, Steve, I'm glad you're dreaming about me. Yes. That makes me feel good. I was a Boy Scout in Central Florida. Any other fellow Boy Scouts out there in the audience? Previous Boy Scouts, I guess. We love the Girl Scouts too. Any Girl Scouts? Got some devotees back here. So that's what my story is about tonight. It's about my time, my very developmental time as a Boy Scout in Central Florida. Not a lot of great Alaska here, but Florida-centric. Anyway, the wildlife in Florida is much smaller than what you're used to here. We've got black bears for sure. They're about the size of large dogs, so not very intimidating. That didn't stop any scoutmasters from telling us the gory stories of young scouts getting eaten in their tents if they didn't brush their teeth at night. So that still stuck with us. We still had that fear of God in us. Anyway, 12 years old, we had sold enough popcorn to get us to Camp Daniel Boone in North Carolina. A big deal, big destination. As a Floridian, North Carolina represented the last frontier, right? Big mountains, giant wildlife, just surrounded in mystique. So yeah, we were all gearing up for Camp Daniel Boone. It was gonna be the highlight of the summer. We were all excited, my troop and I was part of the Troop 699 based out of Eustis, Florida. And we were part of the, I'm sure a lot of people from Eustis here. Anyway, I was in the Flaming Sharks Patrol. Little backstory behind that. The Sharks merged with the Flaming Arrows and became the Flaming Sharks. Anyway, had a lot of good friends in the Flaming Sharks Patrol. Headed up to Camp Daniel Boone, all very excited, and we had one big goal in mind. There was this very coveted merit badge. It was the Wilderness Survival merit badge. And all of the older scouts, they had it. And they were total mum about it. They wouldn't say a word. We'd ask them, so what do we have to do to get this? You're clearly not old and wise enough to understand. So it was surrounded in secrecy and mystique. And so obviously when we get there, there's this big cafeteria and there's tables all around about the size of this room. They had the name of the merit badges kind of scrawled on paper there, and there's an older scout waiting at the table looking very intimidating. Well, we walk into the cafeteria, the far back corner, scrawled on a card, just the letters WS. And we're supposed to know what that means, right? It's this legendary merit badge. So WS, great, Wilderness Survival. We head over there. A very stoic older scout looks at us in silence. It's me and three friends. We're all 12 years old, looking very tough. Walk up to him very confidently, grab the sign-up sheet, scrawl our names in. Again, older scout doesn't say a word to us. All he does, reach behind him, pick up four rusty coffee cans, and slams them on the table in front of us. We kind of take a step back. Okay, what does this mean? We don't know what this merit badge is about, but we want it. We definitely want it. So the only words that come out of his mouth, nothing comes that doesn't fit in this can. And then we'll see you at 10 p.m. on the last night of camp. Like, oh, okay, all right. So the whole next week, obviously, we don't do anything else but scheme what's going in this can. We don't know what to expect, but we have to do the right thing. We gotta put these right things in these cans. And so the original plan, myself, Kyle, Kevin, and Taylor, dynamic duo, or four of us, we originally have a plan. We're like, okay, let's think about this. Pierce, you're in charge of the shelter, so you get whatever we need to stay dry at night. We think we're gonna be overnight. All right, Kyle, you take care of the food, and then Kevin, you get all the water, and then Taylor, you get the weapons, because we definitely need weapons. So standard issue, pocket knife, probably 2 inches long. Every Boy Scout has it. Swiss Army, I have it to this day. But anyway, that was his job. So anyway, we had this great plan. We spend the whole next week scheming about it, fitting things into the can, make sure they fit. We talk to the older scouts. Of course, we get absolutely no information out of them. We're like, does this work? Will this be good? What happens? We don't know. So anyway, we get up to the right before the last night, and every man for himself mentality takes over. We're like, screw the plan. I don't trust any of you. I'm taking my own stuff, right? I don't trust Kyle to make sure that we get enough water. Kevin's definitely not bringing enough food. I'm taking my own stuff, and everyone felt the same way. So right before we started, in my coffee can, I had a roll of duct tape, a sheet of plastic, my Swiss Army knife, of course, and about 2 pounds of gummy bears. And I felt very prepared for this. No rope. What kind of Boy Scout doesn't bring rope? I was a terrible Boy Scout and never learned any knots. To this day, I don't know any knots. So don't ask me about knots, because I'm terrible at the knots. So anyway, I had the roll of duct tape. Have the can ready. 10 p.m., last night of camp rolls around. We're extremely nervous, but we have our cans with us. No flashlights, nothing like that. That would have been smart. Anyway, march up to the trailhead where we're supposed to meet at 10 p.m. very dutifully. There's probably another 25 scouts from different troops with us, all geared up to experience whatever happens at 10 and 10 p.m. on the last night of camp. We all have our rusty coffee cans in our hands, looking very sheepish. Nobody's talking. Finally, two older scouts roll up. Fortunately, they have flashlights. Again, no explanation. All they say is, okay, follow us. So, all right. So we walk down this trail. I don't know. It felt like miles in total silence, total dread of what's going to happen to us out here. Again, a bunch of Floridians, and we're in the woods at night in North Carolina. Things are giant. We have no idea what to expect. So anyway, march in silence, total darkness. Nobody brought flashlights. What seems like miles, we finally arrive to a clearing. And the older scouts are like, okay, I'm going to give one walkie-talkie to one of you. We don't want to hear from any of you until the morning. Goodbye. They turn around and walk up. And so we just kind of look around. We all have our coffee cans in our hands, like, okay, I guess we need to like build a shelter or something. So we all get to work. Again, we had these great plans of how we're all going to work together as a team and build this great shelter, and that all fell apart. We were totally terrified. So we just scurry out of the woods, and I get my sheet of plastic out and my roll of duct tape and start trying to tape things to trees, and it goes really poorly. It starts raining, of course, and I just give up. I said, okay, I'm gonna wrap myself in this sheet of plastic. I got my gummy bears out. I was like, okay, we're just gonna wait out the night and hopefully we survive until whatever in the morning. And I know there's huge black bears and stuff out here, so it was absolutely terrifying. One of those nights you'll never forget. Anyway, remember, one scout had a walkie-talkie. Some other lame troop, not the good Central Florida troop that was up there. We didn't need that walkie-talkie. Anyway, about 2 hours into the night, the older scouts show back up. They had their flashlights and they yell, okay, which one of you called us on the radio? And not me, nobody did it. But they walk up to the scout they gave the walkie-talkie to. And he's like, I left it with that group over there. And so they walk over to the other group over there, and they're like, we haven't touched the radio. And the older scout's like, we cannot believe you guys. You said somebody was injured, and now we have to march all of you back. And again, we had been out there for all of 2 hours. And they're like, oh, no way. We were so prepared and ready for this. That's so disappointing. And so, of course, we all get up. I pack up my roll of duct tape. I'm covered in tape and stuff, and I get it all as well as I can, and we slowly march back, and the whole way we're saying to our buddies, like, I cannot believe that somebody did that. We're so disappointed. And all the while, we're like, oh, thank God. We were so terrified out here on our own in the night in North Carolina, just this terrible, terrible place. We get back to camp. Again, nobody said a word. We, to this day, we don't know who got on the walkie-talkie and saved us all. But at the end, we all went back to Florida. It was a great camp experience. We got our Wilderness Survival merit badges, and nobody said a word to anybody else about what happened that night. Thank you.
Thanks, Pierce. And I want to give our storytellers another hand. Thanks, everybody.